Thanks for downloading from the BBC. Get more technology news at bbcnews.com and click on Technology.
This is the BBC World Service, also podcasting via the BBC News website. Hello, I'm Gareth Mitchell, and welcome to our weekly look at the world of technology. This is Digital Planet. And today, what's going on in your neighbourhood? Well, now there's a website to tell you.
What we've been doing is trying to grab all the people who are blogging about their communities, all the news stories from traditional media, things coming from governments, new data points, real estate openings, and put that all in one place.
And guess what? You have a 19th century epidemiologist to thank for that. And one of the most widely used web animation applications becomes 10 years old, proving it's not a flash in the pan.
It's all about the entertainment side and creating a really rich user experience that encompasses video, animation, sound. And if you want to present that kind of content on the web, then you don't really have much choice.
That's all to come right here on Digital Planet from the BBC. But first up, blogging has become a democratising force online, allowing anyone who likes the sound of their own voice, or typing basically, to sound off on matters close to their heart, potentially to any of the world's billion or so internet users. But what if you don't have access to a computer, or you're illiterate? You still deserve your own place in the blogosphere. Well, that's what one blogger in Delhi believes, and that's her message to a blogging get-together in the Indian capital. Sanjukta Basu is telling the Global Voices meeting about her project to bring blogging to everyone, no matter how disadvantaged. And now she's in our BBC Delhi studio to tell me all about it. So, Sanjukta, welcome to the programme.
Yeah, hi.
And the idea then is you're going to bring, you know, blogging to people who wouldn't usually have a voice. So how exactly?
Yeah. Well, the idea, you know, is that to begin with, those who cannot blog, if we give them blogging computer or something, can they blog? They still cannot because they don't know technology and they're illiterate. So what if somebody else does that on their behalf for them? For that, I thought, how about, you know, we get hold of those people who are technology savvy and who has the time and resource to do it, but they really don't know about blogging. So I thought of, how about we get together a group of students or social workers and tell them about blogging, the amazing thing that is, and tell them how information can reach to the largest global community, that is the internet, and with just a push of a button in real time and with no, you know, fancy equipment, not spending much money on that. And once they're aware of the concept of blogging, which is a very interesting thing, they might want to take up the causes of those illiterates and, you know, those less privileged ones who cannot directly reach out to the world. So we can have a team of bloggers who are blogging on behalf of, say, a farmer or, say, an HIV positive person.
Right. And so the idea is, in a way, that these bloggers would interview the illiterate person or
not
the farmer or...
No, not exactly interview, because when you ask questions, people might not answer you very interestingly, but how about just take a look at their life and, you know, blog about their life and, say, spend a day or two with them, record videos, how they go about, you know, with their daily life and the issues they face. Yeah, in their day-to-day life.
And that's very interesting as a parallel with journalism, isn't it? Because, you see, I was wearing my journalist hat there, assuming that if I want to give somebody out there a voice, you know, I stick a microphone in front of them and interview them. And you're quite right. By its very nature, I'm kind of mediating that encounter, aren't I? You're saying this whole thing is freer than that. You know, it's not the blogger in this case trying to make the person's message for them.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you're right, it's parallel journalism. That is the birth of journalism also, in that very concept of, you know, taking reaching out to people who cannot themselves reach out. But the difference between journalism and blogging here would be that you don't need so much of fancy equipment. You have a first-hand information, and the information would reach to the whole world in real time. So not restricted to the area of circulation of the newspaper or to the area of transmission of that particular TV channel.
Right.
So it's reaching to the whole world.
Okay. And Sanjukta. Let's hear now from Bill Thompson. He joins us in our studio. He's our weekly commentator, if you like. Bill, it sounds as if Sanjukta is building on similar ideas that we've seen in the United States, isn't it?
That's right. Two or three years ago, and there were lots of tales from particularly Seattle and San Francisco about homeless people spending time in the city's libraries and using the free internet access and computers there to write their own blogs. And that became very important for them as a way to sort of be politically active, to try to change their conditions. And this seems to be a very imaginative way to extend the scope of the blogosphere to encompass people who don't have access to technology and may not even be literate.
And just in a final few seconds there, Sanjukta, I mean, do you have any of these people who wouldn't usually have voices now already lined up, ready for you guys to give them a voice?
No, not really. We don't have already because we just started with the idea. But we just conducted a workshop with students and they are pretty much enthusiastic about it, and they said they would be doing their field research and would be blogging about it. So they regularly go to the field to meet these farmers or these less privileged people, street children, HIV positive people, prostitutes, and they already are very enthusiastic about it, and they said that we would be having a collaborative blog where we can archive all our field research.
Okay. And Sanjukta, just a quick point from Bill.
I just think it's going to be great to see what the people who are being blogged about think of this when they actually sort of start to get some feedback.
It's fascinating. Well, look, Bill, thanks for that. And to you, Sanjukta Basu, over there in Delhi, good luck with the project. And in fact, whilst that meeting's taking place in Delhi this week, another further east in Calcutta in India has drawn to a close. Kolkata, as the city's now officially known in India, has been hosting the country's biggest annual technology get-together, the Infocom Conference and Exhibition. As organising secretary, Didi Porkayesta was the man running the event, so I caught up with him, and I put it to him that Calcutta may seem a rather unlikely choice for such a big IT event, because usually when you think about technology in India, you know, you used to think of Hyderabad and Bangalore.
We are now positioning this event as a global connect to Indian IT industry, because this is now the country's biggest IT show. And we are promoting this across the world. CNN is our media partner this year, and this is promoted as the platform where the world can come and meet with the IT industry of India.
And what kind of IT is here in particular? I mean, is it manufacture, telecommunications? You know, what exactly is going on?
Like I can tell you, IBM has got a huge setup here. They're recruiting in large numbers, Cognizant, PwC. Basically, it is a software development center, because these people here are very, very cerebral. So it is more, it is not less a voice call center, it's more software solutions. And obviously, all the IT companies are considering Calcutta now as a very favorable destination.
That's Didi Porkayesta. But the plot thickens. West Bengal, of which Calcutta is the capital, is actually a communist state. And sure enough, when free enterprise capitalism and Marxism collide, controversy is never far away. And those tensions emerged right at the beginning of the meeting at the inaugural press conference.
There is a feeling amongst the unions that the companies are exercising, they're creating a climate of fear in which the employees are not being allowed to exercise their right of joining a union.
You don't usually get that at a press conference like that. Very tough questions being asked there over workers' rights in West Bengal, with suggestions that the incoming IT companies are refusing workers access to trade unions. And the atmosphere in the region is already highly charged after India's principal car manufacturer built a factory in the area, with farmers forced off their lands to make way for the industrial sites. An opposition politician is on hunger strike over the issue, and a car showroom was smashed up, so feelings running very high. Now, one of the local journalists present at that heated press conference at Infocom was Divadeep Purohit of the Calcutta Telegraph newspaper. And afterwards he told me that the tensions in the region are being amplified by relatively new domestic demand for IT within India, alongside that from abroad.
What we have seen in our country, if you look at the way the IT industry has behaved, it's an IT, that is information technology industry, they have behaved. They have always looked at the world outside India, because the big bucks, the dollars, were there. So their focus was the US. They only talked about the US and Europe. But now, since they have reached a certain stage, a critical mass, so now they are looking internal as well. So they were bothered only about the roads, the connectivity and all those issues. They were not interested about the farmers. They were not interested about the poorest of the poor. But now they are looking at all those things. Because now, while the industry is growing, the domestic industry also has become a market for these IT companies. So earlier it was a world market, but now the domestic market gives them a great potential. So this is pure business sense. I mean, it's not that they are very bothered about the plight of the farmers. I mean, capitalists will always remain capitalists and the farmers will remain farmers. But this is a great business opportunity in the domestic market, which they want to tap. And in the process, they want the farmers to be benefited, because if the farmers are not benefited, if the farmers have resentment and the problems, then you will have social problems.
That's Divadeep Purohip speaking to me there in Calcutta. So, Bill Thompson, this is fascinating, because this was, you know, an IT conference, all this cutting-edge stuff, and before we knew it, the press conference had shifted to talking about workers' rights and Marxism, basically.
Yeah, and it's, in fact, it's surprising, but it should be expected, that if you've got sort of new developments in countries which are changing very quickly, like India, you're going to get these conflicts coming up from time to time, and they do need to be resolved. It's not surprising that the farmers are unhappy at all.
I suppose this is just a sign of how quickly India, and that region in particular, West Bengal, is developing.
It is, and you have a government which is concerned about protecting workers' rights, not just farmers' rights, and they're going to come into conflict. In many senses, sort of your IT production is the new textiles. What you're getting are lots of people who are working in factories. There are many places where it's cheaper to get people to put components in circuit boards than it is to have a machine do it, and those people often don't get very well paid. We're seeing the same sort of sweatshop conditions being reported as we've seen in the textile industry. What we want to make sure is that doesn't happen, that as new factories are built and new systems are put in place, we don't see a replication of the appalling exploitation of people we saw in the 1980s and 90s.
And I was reading one of your columns on the BBC News website recently, and you cited Karl Marx and Engels, I think. Do you think then that, sort of communism, and this is a communist state, that, you know, sort of Marxism and free enterprise can live happily just about together?
Well, I mean, India is a very good example of countries where that can happen, where you have, if you like, pragmatic Marxism and pragmatic capitalism getting along together and trying to do something which will benefit the world community and the large companies, but also benefit the individuals. And what we have to hope is they find a model which allows full rights for the workers, reasonable pay, and also high enough productivity to justify investment there that could then be expanded around the world. India is ahead of the curve here. It can be a great model for other countries.
Great, Bill. Thanks very much for that. This is Digital Planet, on air, online, and podcasting to your MP3 player from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Gareth Mitchell, and still to come, 10 years old and still as flash as ever. No, I'm not talking about Bill. We're asking where next for the ubiquitous animation application that puts the rousing into browsing. All right, well, if you live in a big city, the man you have to thank for making it all possible is a character called John Snow. In 1854, he found himself in London in the midst of a cholera outbreak. Nobody knew how the disease was spreading, so Mr. Snow and his friend, a Reverend Henry Whitehead, drew a map of the area and then marked on it where the water pumps were and the locations where cholera was reported. And sure enough, the cases of disease were linked to one pump, and that showed that the illness was associated with contaminated water, leading basically to sanitation techniques that allowed people to live in large urban concentrations without poisoning each other. And so the era of the megacity was born. And if John Snow's overlaying of maps reminds you of something, it might be today's online equivalent, thanks to computing applications where we mark local features of our choice on detailed electronic maps, although thankfully today those locations are more like to be libraries or bars, things like that. Well, if you find that revelation inspiring, then you're in good company, because so does New York writer Stephen Johnson. He's written a whole book on the idea. It's called Ghost Map, referring to that prophetic map that John Snow originally put together in 1854. Well, Stephen Johnson came in for a chat earlier, and Bill and I spoke to him.
Every great neighborhood has the folks who know, you know, tons of people who have great social connections, who know exactly where the best pub is, or where the, you know, which new piece of real estate is the most overvalued, or what's going on at the local school. And what the web gives you is the opportunity to, in a sense, amplify those voices and not have them just rely on kind of word-of-mouth structures, but actually let them talk to kind of a slightly larger audience about what's going on in their community.
And also to convey those things graphically. And, you know, when Jon Snow and Henry Whitehead put these, pumps on the ghost map, then we immediately think of those sort of Google Earth maps, possibly, little pins on that represent where restaurants are. Or, as Bill Thompson reminded us, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, for instance, if we look at a totally different and I suppose more serious scenario, the places where people might be able to get help, or whether the levels of higher ground were, etc.,
or where people had moved to, so where people could be found, on their address you could find where they'd relocated to. And I think sort of Stephen's absolutely right to say that we can use the technology locally in really quite impressive ways. A researcher, a social science researcher in the UK called Will Davis, coined the term proxy communication. Because it's not about telecommunication, it's not just about making connections over long distance and this idea of telecommuting. The network really makes a difference to your locality and to the connections you have with the people around you.
It's absolutely right. And one of the things that I've just put together kind of in sync with Ghost Map is this new site called Outside In, which is right now in the US, but we're going to be expanding to other countries. And what we're doing is trying to say, okay, look, the unit of information that is really most powerful for people in terms of their daily lives is really the unit outside of their family, is the unit of the neighborhood. That's the kind of scale that people really think about. What's happening in my kind of community in this, larger town or city? The web offers a way around that. And so what we've been doing is trying to grab all the people who are blogging about their communities, all the news stories from traditional media that are related to a given neighborhood or a given kind of spot in a neighborhood, things coming from governments, new data points, real estate openings, and put that all in one place so that you can go to this site and say, I'm here right now in the middle of this neighborhood. What's happening around me? What are the conversations? What are the locals saying? What are the, the experts saying about this community right now? And you can literally just drag the map, zoom in, zoom out, and you get a different kind of view of all those conversations.
It's very similar, I think, to what's happening in the news media at the moment. Everyone who's talking about what's happening, particularly to US newspapers, is talking about the drive to hyperlocal, the need to make things relevant to the community, to the neighbourhood, that national news is available from so many different sources. There's no point if you're a local paper having a reporter in Washington or London, wherever. What you want are people on the ground, and it seems you're trying to tap into that and then use this geographical metaphor to make it possible to navigate that in a very different way from, say, a newspaper front page.
And it's interesting because in recent weeks on this program, we've been talking a lot about social networking and people hanging around in virtual environments like Second Life and so on. Outside In, in a way, it's turning that inside out. And saying, hang on, folks, how about hanging around in your own real space, in your real localities? There's an idea. That's interactivity for you.
Exactly right. I mean, one of the things that inspired me, I'm actually on the advisory board of this company, is Meetup, which was all about this idea of using the connective power of the web to introduce you to people who might share an interest, but then forcing you to get together in real life. So to me, the great success in all of this is if we can, again, use these kind of virtual technologies to make real-world spaces more along the lines of kind of the great urban values that we've always prided ourselves on having in great cities, civic conversation between strangers about issues that we really care about in local communities.
Is there anything new about this? I know the technology's new, but, for decades and decades, we've had, the local shop, which has a notice board in, and people put cards up saying, I've lost my cat, or this is for sale, that's for sale.
Yeah.
Are we basically just kind of reinventing what we've been doing all along through sort of traditional means of communication and exchanging information?
Let me give you an example why I think it is fundamentally different. Right before we launched this site, Outside In, I was on book tour for Ghost Map, and I showed up in Denver, Colorado, a city I don't know at all, and I'm in my hotel, and I have this, which city am I in kind of moment, and I wake up in the morning, and I look, and I think, I wonder if we're actually covering Denver yet. And so I go to my hotel phone and get the zip code for the neighborhood I'm in, and I type that into this site, Outside In, and immediately comes up, and I can see that we actually have some information for this neighborhood. And one of the things I see in the left-hand side is the top tags, kind of themes that people are writing about. And the number three theme for this neighborhood is the architect Daniel Libeskind. And I'm like, what? Why? What is that? And then
you'd expect it to be the local leisure center.
Exactly.
Or something.
Yeah. And then I realize, oh, right, there's a huge new museum that Libeskind built in downtown Denver. That's interesting. And so I read through all these blog posts from, four or five local bloggers who've written their thoughts about this museum and the controversy. So I get this great kind of local interpretation of what people really think about these things and what the kind of terms of the controversy are. And then I go to my window and I open the drapes, and there's the museum. And so the first time I see it, it's entirely, you know, contextualized with all this kind of local conversation. And I literally just could not have done that before. And the only way I could have done it is maybe going out in the middle of the street and kind of asking people, like, what's the big topic that you're all debating about, and tell me some color commentary on what that is. But nobody really does that. Whereas I could do it, thanks to the web, you know, in just a few clicks. I was introduced to what was really the kind of driving issue of this physical space, and then I could go out and explore that space.
So, Bill Thompson, does all this technology mean that we really can think again about the virtues that are sometimes overlooked of living in cities, or in this case, in this example, visiting a city?
For me, it's more reassurance that we can start to make them work again, and that we can cope with the problems of scale. And, you know, the Ghost Map is about how cities, how London decided to cope with the problem of sewage, and how that made the growth of London into, you know, a world city possible. Well, there is a parallel, not necessarily between sewage and the World Wide Web, let's not go there, but there is definitely a parallel between the ways we are now able to use technology because of the pervasiveness of the internet, because certainly here in the developed West, so many people do have access to allow new forms of city living to emerge, which themselves are scalable in the same way as we managed to build the megacities originally in the Victorian times, so we can carry on and maintain and sustain them.
That's Bill Thompson with Stephen Johnson as well, of course. Okay, now finally to the web animation package Flash, no doubt one of the most successful and pervasive technologies on the web. And now it's 10 years old. It started life called Future Splash, and now it's part of the Adobe empire, and the firm claims it's used by 90% of people on the web. So, as Rami Sabar has been finding out, if you're thinking that Flash is just so 1990s, then think again.
Hi, I'm Seb Lee Dalal from Plugin Media. I'm the technical director there, and I'm a speaker here at Flash on the Beach in Brighton. Flash is, has its own specific purpose on the web. It's all about the entertainment side and creating a really rich user experience that encompasses video, animation, sound. And if you want to present that kind of content on the web, then you don't really have much choice apart from Flash. It's got the highest take-up rates on the web. I think currently 85-90% of people have the Flash 8 player, which is the fastest take-up rate on any new technology on the internet.
A conference like this brings together hundreds of developers, designers and illustrators, many of whom are increasingly working exclusively in Flash. As new versions evolve, currently Flash 8 and soon Flash 9, so the creative limits of the software are pushed further and further into new areas of digital media and culture.
It's quite an interesting journey, really, because 10 years ago when Future Splash came out, it was just simply as a way to present animated graphics on a web browser. But I mean, since then, it's just grown and grown. I mean, there's people taking it in other areas, producing installations with it in museums, webcams for user interface, lots of tactile computing. And because it's so powerful, you are finding that people are playing with it and experimenting with it and finding extra uses for it other than what it was initially designed for.
What Flash is best known for, however, is animation, which most agree has been revolutionised, and not just on the web. Increasingly, Flash-based content is broadcast on television. It's just another innovation in this industry, driven in part by economics, explains Dominic Minns, creative director of Plugin Media.
It happened in the 60s when Hanna and Barbera came up with laying on different cells on top of each other so that they only had to change the drawing of a head. You remember Yogi Bear and all those characters, they've all got a necktie on, and it's so that they don't have to draw the body again. They can just do a different head and you don't see the join where the tie is. And that made animation back then a lot cheaper and able to be mass-produced for telly. And that's happening now with Flash, in the way that Flash works, in that when you animate for Flash, you build up libraries of different animations, like someone running, someone talking, all your different mouse shapes you need. And once those libraries are there, you just have to call them in to whatever scene you're producing. So you're not having to constantly redraw and redraw and redraw stuff. It's all there, so making it incredibly cheap to produce and to a high standard.
What you're hearing is a game called Kamikaze, written in Flash Lite for a mobile phone. Adobe hopes its mobile platform will offer serious competition to Java in the mobile games industry. But without the ability to match the graphics of Java, let alone a true games console, can Flash Lite really offer better mobile gaming? Richard Leggett, a senior developer from all media agency AKQA based in London, believes the limitations of Flash Lite can be turned into an advantage.
It makes you really think about what you're making, because you've got so many limitations in play that you actually concentrate on the quality. It's like taking gaming over from Nintendo, who really concentrate on how things work over the graphics. They just want it to be fun, and that's the key. And also the fact that you can make many, many, many more games, because you can make them in smaller teams in quicker timescales, not have to test them so much. For example, a movie comes out. 2 days later, you can have a game for that movie, and that could get distributed by a paper the very next day. So they've instantly sold a bunch of copies of a game to their audience.
Whilst Flash has many followers, it also has plenty of critics who point out its checkered history of security flaws and its increasing use in ever more intrusive online advertising campaigns. The result is a growing market in software that blocks Flash applications from running on your computer. Even at Brighton's Flash on the Beach, there's a whiff of dissent. New York-based freelance Flash and Java developer Jeff Stearns believes that for Flash to be more accepted in a Web 2.0 world, developers and designers need to think more carefully about when and how to use it.
There's a lot of people in the past where they've been using Flash, sort of abusing it and using it for everything, and that's not really the best way to do it. As with any other technology for the web, you should always use it for what it's best for, where use it in appropriate situations and don't overuse it. And I am a big fan of, you know, less is more type of idea and thinking.
Jeff Stearns ending that report from Rami Sabar, wishing Flash a 10th birthday. So, Bill, it's just so pervasive, isn't it?
It is, and there is a good reason for that, which is that Flash is cross-platform. As we heard, it will run on almost anything. And also, no matter which browser you're using, if you're using Internet Explorer or Netscape or Firefox or something, there is a Flash plugin for it. And that means it's actually much broader than anything else. The real danger is, again, as we heard, it will be abused. That there are things Flash isn't very good for. You know, it can be quite small, but it can also be quite irritating. And what we need are designers to be very aware of their audience, design appropriately, and only use Flash where it is actually called for.
As Jeff Stern said, less is more. Bill, thanks for that. We'll see you again next week. That's it for this week. Just a quick reminder, as ever, that our podcast is available from bbcworldservice.com. Just go there, look for the A to Z drop-down list of programmes and find Digital Planet. And the rest is pretty simple. You can have our podcast and listen to it at your leisure. Our email address is digital.planet@bbc.co.uk. We'll have more for you in 7 days' time. But from me, Gareth Mitchell, and producer Rami Sabar, thanks for listening and goodbye.